Welcome back to another episode of City Hall Pass. I'm Kapel Lungani, counsel to the mayor of New York City. We created this forum, the first of its kind in New York City, to give you, the public, a unique window into the highest levels of our city government. We interview New York City's finest public servants and get them to open up in a way that is both deeply personal and insightful. And on its best days, we hope that our podcast is equal parts educational and inspiring. And now I want to introduce my two co-hosts today, two brilliant women who inspire me every day, Bess Chu and Kate Coughlin.
Thanks, Kapel. Happy to be here. This is Bess Chu. I'm currently Chief of Staff to the Office of the Counselor to the Mayor.
Hi, I'm Kate Coughlin, and I currently serve as Deputy Counsel for the Office of the Counselor to the Mayor.
I'm excited to introduce our guest for this episode, former Commissioner of the Department of Investigation, otherwise known as DOI, Margaret Garnett. Commissioner Garnett was nominated by Mayor de Blasio in November of 2018 and confirmed by the City Council in the same month. DOI acts as one of the oldest municipal anti-corruption agencies in the country, with goals of rooting out corruption, wrongdoing, negligence, and abuse from New York City, while furthering integrity and upholding New Yorkers' confidence in government. Prior to joining DOI, Commissioner Garnett served as Executive Deputy Attorney General for Criminal Justice in the Office of the New York State Attorney General, where she supervised more than 150 prosecutors and 130 criminal investigators. She previously spent 12 years as a federal prosecutor in the Office of the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, otherwise known as the SDNY, where she was responsible for prosecuting gang violence, racketeering, organized crime, violent crime, financial crimes, and tax fraud. We spoke to former Commissioner Garnett about her storied career in public service, some of the most memorable investigations from her time at the Southern District, her vision for DOI, and much more. We hope you enjoy.
All right, it gives me great pleasure to welcome one of New York's finest lawyers, Margaret Garnett, to City Hall Pass. Commissioner Garnett, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Margaret, I want to start by asking a couple questions about your background, because you have a really, really interesting background. And then we'll talk a little bit about your career. You grew up as a military kid, is that right?
That's right. And we moved every 1 to 2 years, mostly. Both of my parents were also military kids. They both also grew up with career military fathers. So they had grown up in that life themselves. And yeah, we lived all over the place.
Margaret, you've spent the majority of your career in public service. Who or what instilled a love for public service in you?
Well, as I said, I'm a military kid, and, you know, really my family on both sides, particularly on my father's side for many generations, has been a pretty consistent line of career military service. So I really grew up very steeped in that was to have a career that was about service to your country, service to others, doing work that felt like it mattered for important values. Until I was in high school, I really didn't know any adults other than sort of teachers, doctors, the people you meet as a kid. I didn't know any adults who did anything else other than that. So, you know, I really don't know a time that I didn't have that as kind of a core model, that's a good way to be a grown-up.
Yeah, I feel the same. My parents are both public servants, and I didn't know any other way of growing up either. When did you first remember thinking you might want to become a lawyer?
Probably around junior high. I don't know why or how I got that idea, because I didn't know any lawyers. We have no lawyers in my family. You know, I think maybe whether it's from books or popular culture or, you know, teachers who may have encouraged me, but I remember gradually thinking that when I was junior high, high school, and people start asking you, what do you want to do, that I thought I might maybe be a reporter or a lawyer. And I went to college thinking that, you know, I thought I probably wanted to be a lawyer. I've always loved like puzzles, detective stories. Even when I was a kid, I loved mysteries and detective stories. And I was always a voracious reader and a good writer. And so from the teacher standpoint, I think that was a factor in kind of saying, maybe, you know, you might think about this. But I think for me, a lot of it was about this sort of like investigator, detective kind of way of thinking and solving puzzles. But I also really liked the idea of being an expert who helps people, right? And I think a lot of what is great about being a lawyer is that you have this expertise, right, that other people don't have. And it's an expertise in a really complicated and consequential part of modern society, whatever your specialty is. If you trust in estates, family law, or you're a criminal lawyer like I am, and people come to you with their worst problems and you can help them. You can be a companion to them, or you can be an expert who really solves the problem. So I think that kind of idea was always very attractive to me.
You started your legal career as an associate at Wachtell Lipton. I mean, it's a law firm that's routinely ranked, I think, number one in the country or at the very top. Can you tell us about your experience at Wachtell?
I had a wonderful experience there as a new lawyer. You know, I definitely went into law firm life expecting to hate it. I viewed it as a transaction in which I would trade my hard work for what I thought of at the time, and really still today, an extraordinary amount of money. You know, when I was a first-year associate, I made more than my parents combined had ever made in any year of their lives. I knew what I was doing. It was a trade-off. I was going to do it to retroactively pay for law school. And then my real career would start. My real life would start once I had done that. But much to my surprise, I found I really liked it.
Margaret, you eventually did decide to leave Wachtell, and you went to what many consider the crown jewel of the Department of Justice, the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Southern District of New York, where you spent 12 years as a federal prosecutor. While you were there, you were responsible for prosecuting gang violence, racketeering, organized crime, violent crime, financial crimes, tax fraud, a real cornucopia of crimes. Was there any particular unit that you enjoyed more than others? I mean, you eventually became Chief of Appeals. But was there a particular unit growing up at the SDNY that you particularly, looking back on it, that you particularly enjoyed?
Yeah, I think my heart will always be in the violent crimes work. I sort of fell into it. I when I came to the office and I was in general crimes, which is what we call the first year of every assistant U.S. attorney in that office, I was asked but really assigned to work on a huge tax fraud case that was set to go to trial at that time in about a year. And that's fairly common in the office, that a huge complex trial, you might add a junior person just to sort of, you know, be the junior associate in law firm terms. You know, I think I was asked to do that in part because I had come from Wachtell Lipton and I had a lot of experience on complex financial cases. What was supposed to be kind of a 1 year, you'll do this, and then once the trial's over, you'll join your classmates in narcotics, turned into sort of a 3 year odyssey. As the things were winding down for that case, the bosses there at the time had said, well, you know, like you've done your service to the office by doing this huge thing and sticking with this case. And, you know, what do you think you'd like to do? And at the time, I just wanted something completely different. I felt like I have to do something totally different. Because when I became a prosecutor, I really thought I would be most interested in doing white collar cases, public corruption, financial fraud. That's really what I was drawn to when I joined the office. And I'd wanted something different. And so I said, well, I think I'd like to go to violent crimes for a little while if there's an opening. So I did that. And I just fell in love with the work, really, and found it incredibly satisfying and rewarding. And I ended up becoming the chief of that unit after a few years and stayed in that role for about 4 years.
Do you have any cases from your time in the violent crime unit that are particularly memorable?
It's really probably the cold case murders, the historical murder cases that I was involved in investigating and charging. And because of the way that you can build a case in the federal system through cooperators and the particular system that the Southern District has for how it develops and uses cooperating witnesses, we prosecuted a lot of old murders that had never been solved. You know, in one of my own cases, we ended up charging almost 15 years after two different murders that happened in the mid 90s that were related to a marijuana, just like a retail marijuana, like selling on the street, bags through the window of a car organization in Washington Heights in the mid 90s. You know, I think those cases, both because they were rewarding for me from that like girl detective perspective of just, it's hard, but incredibly satisfying to investigate things that happened, you know, 15 years ago or more. But also, I think for the family members and loved ones of our victims. Many of them had lived for over a decade or longer, having really no idea. They had no idea. In that case, the Washington Heights case, there were three victims total of the two murders. One was an incident in a store, like a dollar store, underneath the elevated subway in Washington Heights, where our defendants had gone to, they were selling weed from behind the counter in the store, and that was taking their business, was much safer for customers, you know, to go in, you buy a roll of paper towels and a $20 bag of weed at the same time from behind the counter, and then you just walk out with your shopping bag. So they went there to threaten the guy who was working the counter and to burn down the store. They did not intend to kill anyone, but because of how things ended up playing out, they did shoot the clerk behind the counter and he ended up dying. And his family never had, I mean, they had no idea what it was about or why it had happened. You know, everyone thought it was just like this crazy thing that had happened, and their brother and son were dead. And about the second murder had two victims, was a murder for hire. It's kind of an interesting story. The fire murder happens, and the son and his friends, so the Ventura family ran the spot, the drug spot, and the father and a son. And at the time of these murders, the son and his friends were running the spot in the day-to-day. They were like the managers of the spot. And they were the ones that had gone on the father's direction to burn down the store and were responsible for killing the clerk. And the driver, the man who had driven them to the store that day and waited for them in a van to run out, ended up going to the police and saying, "I know who burned down that store." There was a rumor in the neighborhood that a kid had died in one of the apartments above. That was not actually true. But when he heard about that, he was so guilt-ridden that he went to the precinct and said, "I know who burned down that store because I drove them there." And the son, Ventura's son, and his closest friend were charged by the Manhattan DA's office based basically only on this driver. And the friend was at Rikers and the son was on house arrest with an ankle bracelet while the case was pending. They ultimately dismissed the case because the driver, the family sent the driver to the Dominican Republic. Like, "We know it's you and you're going to live with your mother for a while." But while the son was on house arrest for this murder, he obviously couldn't be running the spot and couldn't be seen at the spot. So one of his cousins named Eugene was brought in to run the spot while he was, you know, dealing with this distraction of a murder charge. Then the case eventually is dropped by the Manhattan DA's office. They dismiss the indictment. He's off his house arrest and they say, "Okay, so thank you so much, cousin, for minding the spot for us. We're back. Thank you. We'll see you at the family reunion." And the cousins said, "Oh, no, no, like I'm running the spot now." Of course, that was not acceptable and a big dispute ensued. And so ultimately they decided, well, the cousin has to go. They hired two brothers to kill Eugene, the cousin, that was his name. This is where the second victim comes in. The plan was Eugene was moving out of one apartment to another. The cousins, of course, knew about that, what the day was going to be, and thought, okay, that's going to be perfect because he's going to be coming in and out all day to load the moving truck and everything. So one of the brothers is waiting there in a hallway off the side of the lobby. And Eugene comes down off the, you know, they're like, "Just wait there because he's going to be, you know, multiple times coming down." So he's waiting there off to the side and Eugene steps off the elevator. The gunman steps forward, shoots him in the head twice and starts to just like run out to where his brother's waiting in the car right outside. Unbeknownst to them, Eugene had a friend named Carlos Pena who was helping him with the move. And Carlos was coming back in from the truck and sees this happening. And he has no idea like why or what. Is it a robbery? I don't know. So he tries to tackle the gunman and like take him down, you know, in the lobby, really heroic, like let him get away. They have a struggle and he gets shot in the abdomen, I think twice. Carlos does. And the gunman gets away. The point of all of that is at the time, Carlos's family, his wife and children, they weren't even in New York City. They had gone to visit the wife's relatives in Massachusetts. She's like, you know. So they get a frantic call. Carlos is in the hospital. He's been shot. The wife comes back immediately driving through the night to get back, and he never regains consciousness in the hospital, and he died about a week or two after. So that family really never had any idea. They didn't know Eugene, who was a friend from the restaurant where Carlos worked. They just thought, I guess, you know, he, I don't know, got caught up in some kind of robbery, or it was completely random to them, you know, to be able to tell them what had happened and why, and also tell them that he had died really a hero, like trying to stop this gunman and hold him for the police, prevent him from getting away, was an incredibly memorable moment. And Carlos's widow testified at the trial. And then when the sentencing was happening, we, you know, invited her to come to speak if she wanted to, or just to be present. And after the sentencing, we were saying goodbye and thanking her for, you know, having helped us and been involved in coming to the sentencing. And she said to me, I just, you know, thank you so much. I just always knew that you were out there working. And I said, oh, yes, you know, we've worked very hard in the case, and I'm sorry it's taken so many years, meaning just the 2 or 3 years since we had first contacted her. And she said, no, I mean, after Carlos died and we had no idea why or what had happened. She said, sometimes at night I would be washing the dishes after the kids had gone to bed and thinking about him and thinking about you. And before I knew you, I knew that you were out there working on it. Someone was working on what had happened to Carlos, and that someday we would know and we would have some measure of justice and we would know what had happened. So thank you. I feel like I've known you this whole time. You know, that's obviously a very emotional interaction, but I think it really is kind of symbolic of what is meaningful about this work, that there's the justice aspect of someone who's done something wrong is brought to justice, right? And I think that's kind of like a common way of thinking about it. But what you can do for these families, the feeling that you can be part of sort of setting the world right in some way, you can't bring back people who've been killed. There's nothing you can do about that. But I think that not knowing and feeling like no one cares, like we've had this thing that's at the center of our lives as a family, doesn't seem to matter to anybody and no one is doing anything, is incredibly traumatic, like as much or more traumatic in some ways than the unexpected death of a loved one. And so to do something that you love on a day-to-day basis that also can do that, be part of trying to set that right, it is just incredibly rewarding. For me, it was.
For 17 years, Kathy Watkins and Eric Gleason had insisted that they were innocent of the murder of a livery cab driver. Can you speak a little bit about the role you played in that matter and how you were able to get them successfully released from prison?
When I was the chief of violent crimes, one of our investigators in the violent crimes unit was a man named John O'Malley, who had been an NYPD detective for many years in Bronx homicide, and then came to the U.S. Attorney's Office as an investigator in the early 90s, at kind of the peak of the murder rate in New York City. John was not only a incredibly gifted detective, but also just like a murder encyclopedia of New York City. You know, when you're a prosecutor, you get a lot of letters from inmates who are in jail and who want help with one thing or another. Or typically we would get letters from inmates who offering information that they wanted to trade information for a reduction in their sentence. And so John had a practice with the paralegal who opened the inmate mail that, listen, if you ever get any letter that talks about a murder, I don't care, however outlandish it seems or vague, you just route those letters to me. John's office was right down the hall from mine. And one year in May of 2012, John came down the hall to my office and he said, Margaret, you know, do you have a minute? And he was holding in his hands what I could tell was a handwritten letter on like notebook paper. And he had gotten a letter from an inmate named Eric Lisson. I said, okay, you know, and he said, but the crazy thing is that like he says he knows about this murder in Soundview in the mid 90s. And he said, but the thing is, I think I know what this murder is and who did it. And so he showed me the letter and indeed described, I really think you should look at this gang called Sex Money Murder. And, you know, this cab driver was killed in Soundview in 1995. And, you know, it seemed at first like a typical sort of trading information letter, right? I'm in jail for something else and I've heard about it. And if you'd meet with me, then maybe you could help me. We could help each other. And then at the end, when you flipped it over at the end, it said, please help me. I'm in jail for something I didn't do. where I'm in jail for a murder I didn't commit, and it was signed Eric Lisson. We went back to John's office where he had access to all kinds of databases, and he started, you know, he ran Eric Lisson's rap sheet, and, you know, we started kind of figuring it out. John, early on, was pretty sure that the murder that Eric was in prison for, which was the robbery of a cab driver, and he was killed during the robbery, was the same robbery and shooting that two of our sex money murder cooperators had confessed to, one in the late 90s and one in the early 2000s in two separate sex money murder cases. So we both kind of looked at each other and were like, we better go and see this guy and see what he has to say. And so John went to Sing Sing to visit Eric Lisson. And I remember he called me from the parking lot right afterwards and said, Margaret, I think we're right. And I think this guy is in jail for something. At that point, it had been almost 17 years he'd been in prison. Over that summer, John and I set about trying to figure out like how this had happened, who were the defendants. Kathy Watkins ended up being the second defendant initially in the trial. She had been accused of being the person who called for the cab that then her boyfriend and another man had been in the cab. She had no involvement either, as it turned out. We had been in this situation before where, because we were building all these historical cases and often of murders that had never been solved, that we'd had situations before where cooperators had confessed or told us of their involvement in a murder that someone else is in jail for. The Palladium nightclub murders was another kind of famous one that happened before me. In all of those cases, the previous ones, we had been able to just go to the relevant prosecutor, usually a district attorney in the city, and say, okay, so we have this information. It looks like maybe a mistake was made. The people who are convicted maybe aren't the right people, and sort of work with normally our partners, the district attorneys, to get to the bottom of it, resolve it, get the wrong people out of jail as soon as we could and the right people in. And in this case, that ended up not happening for quite some time. And so we ended up having to take a much more direct role in essentially kind of investigating ourselves, like the trial transcript and the homicide file, and figuring out what had gone wrong and working with the defense lawyers to eventually, we drafted an affidavit for John that was submitted by the lawyers for the defendants as part of their 440, the state version of a habeas proceeding, to eventually get them out. And we learned that Eric Lisson and Kathy Watkins were the two defendants at the first trial, but another five defendants had been convicted in a second trial of this murder and another one that the police at the time thought was related. So it ended up being sort of a huge thing. But eventually, I think with the work of their defense lawyers and our help, all seven were released from prison. We got that letter in May, and I think Eric Lisson and Kathy Watkins were released temporarily on an ankle bracelet in the fall of that year, if I remember correctly. So it was probably like about 6 months before they were out. And then I think it was until January that they were fully, for Eric Lisson and Kathy Watkins, who only been convicted of that one murder, they were fully exonerated. But that whole time, that summer of 2012, when we knew that Eric was at Sing Sing and Kathy Watkins was at Bedford Hills, you know, we really felt like the clock ticking, John and I, knowing that they were in jail, in prison. And, you know, every day that passed was another day that they were in prison for something they didn't do.
You were nominated by Mayor de Blasio in November 2018 and confirmed by the city council the same month. You now obviously lead one of the oldest municipal anti-corruption agencies in the country, tasked with rooting out corruption within city government. Can you talk a little bit about your vision? Or actually, let's take a step back. Why did you take the job?
So it was a job that I hadn't applied for. I got a call asking me if I would be interested in being considered. And it was a very unexpected call. And then everything happened extremely quickly from there. And next thing I knew, like a week, I think less than a week later, there was a press release with my name on it. Even looking back, I'm still kind of amazed at how that happened. But I think what was intriguing to me about it is, you know, definitely, like I always, as I've said, like I always loved investigating things. And it was one of the parts of being a prosecutor that I enjoyed the most. You know, I always would say, like, if I could just investigate cases and then skip right to the trial, that would be ideal, because I really loved both ends of that. And I'll let someone else write the motions in between and, you know, produce discovery and all those kinds of things. But so, you know, I've always loved investigating cases. And so to run an organization that just does that all the time, I think was very attractive. And also, I love New York City. I grew up all as a, you know, a nomad, an itinerant, and I came to New York City early in my adult life. At 25, it was when I moved here permanently. And I've lived here my whole adult life, and I'm raising my kids here, and I just love New York City. So to stay in public service, to be part of making New York City a better place to live and work, was really attractive.
So we're introducing a new game today. It's pretty early in the morning, so I thought it only made sense to bring you a game from everyone's favorite tiger, endorsed Frosted Cereal. Yep, we are back with everyone's favorite game, What Makes Margaret Margaret? All right, so how does this sugary game work? We're going to give you two options, and you pick one, so coffee or tea, for example. All right, are you ready?
I'm ready.
Roberta's or Lucali?
Roberta's.
Army or Navy?
Army, of course.
Encyclopedia Brown or Nancy Drew?
Encyclopedia Brown.
The Fighting Irish or Handsome Dan?
Well, obviously the Fighting Irish.
Okay. Jeopardy or Wheel of Fortune?
Jeopardy.
And can you tell us why you picked Jeopardy?
Long ago, in another lifetime, I was a contestant on Jeopardy when I was in law school.
Okay. And that concludes the first and last game of What Makes Margaret Margaret.
We want to thank the commissioner, not only for her extraordinary public service to the city of New York, but for being a really terrific colleague and somebody who we learn from every day. Commissioner, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule to join us today.
Thank you for having me.
I want to thank our guest, former commissioner of the Department of Investigation, Margaret Garnett, for joining us on City Hall Pass. We hope you enjoyed this conversation and look forward to talking to you soon on another episode of City Hall Pass.